of the room, and even your thoughts will seem to follow in the same direction. An imaginary line will help you properly identify the place in any given location, closest to any given coordination point. Imagine a line drawn from the point of your inner vision, coming from the inner eye you seem to be using outward. Let it be joined by an imaginary line from the top of your skull, following the same direction in which your thoughts seem to flow. You have an imaginary line, then, in this case, from here and here. There is an angle, and then both lines form together. They will point unerringly to the direction closest to a coordination point.
To illustrate this, as she spoke for Seth, Jane touched her eyes with one hand and the top of her head with the other. She extended her hands from these points until they met at arm's length, somewhat off to her right. I sat roughly south of Jane as she faced me, so this meant she indicated the western corner of our living room.
The subordinate points permeate space. Rupert will be able to tell you, for example, the nearest point in this room. Sometimes the angle will be longer, but the two lines will point in the right direction. Energy is, therefore, most effective in those areas.
Long pause.
Now, you may take a break or end the session as you prefer.
We'll take a break. 11:02. Jane was quiet after coming out of a deep trance. I wondered aloud where the nearest coordination point was. This brought forth a torrent of information from her. She'd forgotten it until my remark reminded her of what had happened. Jane said that while speaking for Seth, she knew the two lines she was indicating met in the west by south corner of our room. She walked over to the spot most positively. It was just inside the wall, between two of our bay windows, and in back of an old-fashioned exposed steam pipe. Unfortunately, it was crowded between a heater and bookcase, and wasn't a spot we could put into easy use. Walking about the room, Jane said she felt her thoughts lean in just that direction. Now that she knew where the coordination point was, it seemed incredible to her that she hadn't always known its location. She couldn't possibly lean mentally in any other direction, she said. She turned her back to the spot and gleefully announced that she felt the lines go out to it from the back of her head. Resume at 11:10.
Now, using this analogy of the white hole and the black hole, to make this clearer, the white hole is within the black hole. Do you follow me?
Yes.
Electromagnetic properties are drawn into the black hole and accelerated beyond imagination. The acceleration and the activities within the black hole draw unbelievable proportions.
I checked this word with Seth.
Of additional energy from other systems. This greater acceleration changes the very nature of the units involved. In the meantime, the characteristics of the black hole itself are changed by this activity. A black hole is a white hole turned inside out, in other words. The electromagnetic matter may reemerge through the same hole or point, which is now a white hole. The reemergence, however, again alters its characteristics. It becomes hungry once more, and again a black hole. The same sort of activity goes on in all systems. The holes, therefore, or coordination points, are actually great accelerators that re-energize energy itself. We will end this material for this evening.
An abrupt ending, then, after a long pause, but Seth returned.
Put a note after the material on coordination points, indicating the appendix. This is not our book. This is the appendix to our book.
Okay.
My heartiest good wishes to you, and a fond good evening.
Thank you very much, Seth.
And when you find time for the recorder, I will find time for you.
All right. Good night now. 11:21 p.m. After the session, Jane tried Seth's method for finding coordination points once more. Again, she found herself pointing to the west by south corner of the room. "I got a whole bunch of stuff that time," she said, meaning that she received some extra information after trance. "Those lines form triangular or flue shapes that contain energy. That's why psychics talk about pyramid forms. Those lines keep the energy concentrated." "Sure. That's why I get the triangle effect with Seth 2. Only when I'm in a Seth 2 trance, the coordination point is in a different direction. It goes up from the top of my head, way out of the room and the house into a different reality." Jane then thought of having the members of her ESP class try Seth's method. She wanted to see if they could locate the same spot that she had. Session 594, September 13th, 1971, 9:40 p.m., Monday. Only one session was held last week, and that was a long overdue promised one for friends. Sue Watkins witnessed tonight's session. She intended to leave before session time, but Jane invited her to stay at 8:50. Sue's unexpected presence is a fine example of how spontaneous events can influence a session in a very creative way, as Sue's notes, quoted later, will show. As usual, Jane had no idea of what tonight's session would include. "Stuff for the appendix, I hope," she said. She was in an excellent mood, even a hilarious one. This quality also turned up in the session, in Seth's funny, over-elaborate requests for me to use just the right punctuation and paragraphing. We were late getting started because of my own work in the studio. Talking and laughing, Jane and Sue waited for me to join them in the living room with my notebook. Jane's delivery was quite brisk, with an occasional short pause.
"Now, I bid you good evening and our friend,
Sue.
I would have some interesting comments to make regarding the relationships between you, but we must be up and about with our appendix, and so we will continue that. The other information will come in its own time. Objects are the symbols. You usually think of them simply as realities. You think of thoughts, images, and dreams sometimes as being symbolic of other things, but the truth is that physical objects are themselves symbols. They are the exterior symbols that stand for inner experience. There are, therefore, mass physical symbols upon which you all agree, as well as private personal symbols. The whole nature and structure of physical life as you know it is a symbolic statement made by groups of entities who choose to work with physical symbolism. So the body is a symbol for what you are, or what you think you are, and these may be two different things indeed."
Seth actually made an elaborately humorous request for the dash in the last sentence. Jane, her eyes very dark, leaned far forward over our coffee table and spoke to me in a soft voice.
"Any physical ailment is symbolic of an inner reality or statement. Your entire life is a statement in physical terms, written upon time as you understand it." New paragraph. "Once you understand the symbolic nature of physical reality, then you will no longer feel entrapped by it. You have formed the symbols, and therefore you can change them. You must learn, of course, what the various symbols mean in your own life and how to translate their meaning. To do so, you must first of all remind yourself frequently that the physical condition is symbolic, not a permanent condition. Then you must look within yourself for the inner actuality represented by the symbol. This same process can be followed regardless of the nature of the problem or of your challenge.
9:50.
Your intimate physical environment is, therefore, a symbolic statement of an inner situation. The inner situation is a fluid one, for you are always in a state of becoming. Left alone, you will automatically translate the freely moving, spontaneous inner events into physical reality, therefore altering your environment and changing the symbols. If, however, you imagine that the environment or physical condition is the reality, then you can feel trapped by it and spend your efforts fighting a paper dragon. The environment is always altered from the inside. There is instant feedback between the interior and exterior conditions, but the mobility, the necessity, and the method of changing the physical environment will always come from within. New paragraph.
Again, a very quiet, smiling, and polite request. I'm way ahead of you this time, Seth.
Many of the ideas given in this book can be used most advantageously to solve personal problems. If these concepts are understood, then the individual should realize the freedom he has to operate purposefully within the structure of physical life. Many of you are so used to looking outward and accepting the physical world as the criterion for reality that it has not occurred to you to look within. The entire framework of your existence, therefore, is constantly flowing from within outward and being projected into those physical symbols that you mistake then for reality.
To Sue, who sat beside me on the couch.
I am pretty good on details, too. New paragraph.
Seth burst out with loud and emphatic humor this time because of the work Jane and I have done in recent weeks as we proofread this book, checking all my notes that are included and so forth.
The interior drama, however, is always the important one. The story of your life is written by you, by each reader of this book. You are the author. There is no reason, therefore, for you to view the drama and feel trapped by it. The power to change your own condition is your own. You have only to exercise it. To some other types of consciousness, your physical reality is clearly understood in its symbolic form. Objects, as symbols, help construct the very framework of your existence. They, the objects, can then be manipulated quite freely. You may take your break.
Thank you. 10 o'clock. Jane's pace had been fairly good. Her eyes had been closed often, however, which is rather unusual. The first thing she wanted to know when she came out of trance was if the session contained new material. I had to tell her I didn't know. I'd been too busy writing. Nor could I keep all of Seth's book in mind, even though I was working with a manuscript just now. But then, Jane said, neither could she, and she had just finished reading the whole thing over. A note. Jane was halfway through the final draft of her introduction to Seth's book when this session was held. Sue said the material had a great deal of meaning for her, and that she now realized that it hadn't been an accident that she'd dropped in this evening. She had much more to say here, especially concerning her impressions of Jane, Seth, and the great energy involved in these sessions. It developed that Sue had begun to experience and formulate some impressions both before and during the session. Sue's comments were so very good that I asked her to write them down. She wrote them during the rest of the break, then added to them occasionally through the rest of the session. They are presented here in slightly abridged form. As I sat here before the session, Sue wrote, I got an impression of Seth that I'd never had before. It was as though Jane, Rob, and I were traveling at a certain familiar speed while we were talking, although this has nothing to do with motion. When Seth came around just before the session, it seemed that something within Jane began to crank up, to whirl or accelerate faster and faster, until a certain incredibly other speed was reached. A part of Jane's consciousness that is called Seth. At that point, the speed was right and things clicked somehow. Jane took off her glasses, as she always does. I could almost hear this action. Then, the Seth personality began to communicate. The Seth 2 experience would be an even greater acceleration of this speed, reached at the point of the pyramid effect Jane describes. Even while I told Jane about this during break, I could feel this acceleration begin again, as Jane's consciousness prepared to continue the communication. It was almost an inside-out process of going into trance, and as I watched Seth a few minutes later, it seemed that Jane's consciousness was rushing past her open eyes, beyond my comprehension of what speed is. I now must wonder how the communication ever gets back down to words. I don't mean to say by this that I think Seth and Jane are the same personality. Rather, my feeling is that this acceleration connects portions of the same consciousness that are normally so diverse as to be two separate personalities for all practical purposes. I can recognize the same feeling of acceleration when I'm writing well myself, or even talking enthusiastically. But the feeling of vast, incomprehensible speed behind Seth's eyes goes way beyond that. I could sense the notion of speeds very clearly, both in Jane and Seth, and I felt partly carried along by them. When Jane came out of trance, it was, again, an almost audible experience for me, a feeling of slowing down from a high, airy whine to our normal sound or speed. There was a great sense of change. It was as though part of this acceleration was connected with a dimension where sound was more than a hearing thing. It's a terrific, vital feeling. I could feel it starting up toward the end of each break. Jane resumed at 10:25 at a slower pace.
Now, our friend Sue's observations came very close to an excellent description of Rupert's subjective feelings, as he told you during break. I refer readers to Rupert's introduction, in which he compares his own creative experiences as a writer to those he feels in our sessions. There are several points he did not understand, and so here I would like to clear them.
With a pause.
New paragraph. In our own sessions, he is not aware consciously of the creative work that is being done, precisely because he has gone out of the range that the conscious mind can follow. He has projected a portion of himself into an entirely different kind of subjective reality, a different dimension of activity entirely. Referring to his introduction again, he remarks that he misses the excitement of the chase encountered in his own creative work. Here, you see, the acceleration is so rapid and intense that he is not consciously able to follow it. The unconscious, so-called, has little to do with this phenomenon. It is, however, related strongly to qualities inherent within each consciousness. Such ability is rarely used to full advantage. Connections are made so rapidly that the physical brain is not aware of them.
Pause, one of many, at 10:30.
Rupert has indeed always possessed this ability to a strong degree. For various reasons, reincarnationally speaking, he allowed himself to remain ignorant of the ways in which the ability could be used for the early portion of his life. During sessions, however, all the characteristics of the inner being are accelerated, the knowing, intuitional, creative abilities working at a rate far beyond what you would call the norm. This is a dimension of existence native to consciousness, however, when it is not physically oriented. Rupert can and will learn to explore this dimension even further. Only his lack of confidence in the past held him back. The acceleration propels him into a state in which he can operate quite well, while going beyond all those normal psychological realities that he would personally call his own.
Pause.
In such a state, he literally uses incredible power in terms of energy now, and the volume of the voice in many cases is an attempt to help him use some of this and discharge it while he learns how to use it, and until he is taught other purposes to which it can be put. The volume, of course, can also be used as an excellent demonstration of the vitality with which he is in touch. Now you can take a break. Finish your notes.
Okay.
And I will give Super Jane a rest.
Pause, pointing to Sue.
This one here is waiting for him to come back so she can feel the difference.
10:37. Sue was on the edge of the couch, watching Jane closely as she came out of a deep trance. Once again, she talked about the change in Jane's speeds. A sound goes along with those speeds that I can't describe, Sue said. It's like being in a dimension where music is the reality, where sound is more than just hearing things. Then, when you leave it, Sue whistled, imitating the Doppler effect of a train whistle receding into the distance. When Sue and Jane questioned me about this, I had to tell them that I didn't feel anything out of the ordinary. But then I seldom do during sessions. Concentrating on writing helps close out other effects also. I am always writing, it seems, just as I wrote through most of this break period. Again, Sue watched Jane expectantly as we waited for Seth to return. Wow, the acceleration's terrific, Sue exclaimed. And just before going back into trance, Jane told us she felt the chair vibrating beneath her. Resume, with pauses, at 10:57.
Now, many of the experiences that Rupert has during our sessions he cannot recall afterward. As physical objects are symbols existing as realities within certain frequencies, so there are other realities, of course, at different frequencies. But here, objects are not the main symbols. Experience within such a dimension is extremely difficult to translate when Rupert is back within the physical system. On my part, there are also adjustments that must be made. I step down several levels, for example, so that contact can be made. I then attempt what is indeed a creative endeavor in which Rupert participates, the act of translating such inner data into physical terms, bringing into your reality those clues that I can bring you of these other realities of which you are part.
Pause at 11 o'clock. In a quietly amused manner now, Seth was giving frequent instructions regarding punctuation, etc. Jane's eyes were closed often.
Seen or viewed from my natural perspective, your objects do not exist. Your inner reality does, of course. Now, Rupert's system physically undergoes some changes, although these are largely native to his constitution. He saw to that before his life began. He uses nervous connections in a way that is unusual and to his purpose. His pulse rate is normal. The acceleration begins, however, on a physical level with the use of hormones and chemicals and then leaps from there. Both halves of the brain spark, and from those connections, speaking physically now, the acceleration is initiated and its effects on the body are cut off. Many cases of missing persons can be explained somewhat in the same manner. When the acceleration was strong enough, unexpected enough, to sweep the entire personality out of your system. Now, for our friend's sake, I am speeding up the acceleration to see if she can perceive it. This often takes place during the dream state, and when it seems to you that you have briefly entered an astonishing new dimension, the dream state itself involves such an acceleration.
As I wrote, I took a quick look at Sue beside me. She sat very quietly, watching Jane. Jane's eyes were open now, her pace faster, her voice somewhat louder.
To some extent or another, each artistic creation, though to a lesser degree, involves the same principle. Now, I cannot keep the additional acceleration up, or the voice will go so quickly that our friend cannot keep to his notes.
Jane's voice abruptly grew much louder with the last sentence, an effect Sue and I have witnessed often. This volume was far from her potential when speaking for Seth, however. On some occasions, her voice has been so loud that my ears rang. I've heard Jane keep up very strong voice effects with such ringing peaks for an incredible several hours and without signs of strain afterward.
Now, do not take notes.
His loud and rapid voice soon quieting, Seth explained to me that he would give a fine demonstration of an acceleration in a session in which we used our recorder. Sue could sit in on it, and hopefully I would experience the acceleration as clearly as she does. This interlude ended in a break at 11:10. When Jane came out of trance, Sue was again drastically aware of the drop in Jane's speed. She also had some visual effects that were hard to describe. In an effort to pin these down, she began adding to her own notes, and these are quoted at the end of the session. Sometimes, in ESP class, I would take the whole class with me on a real acceleration adventure if they could go, Jane said. She used the contrasting example of trees in a forest, comparing their passive state to the feeling of acceleration, of being able to go right through the wall that she sometimes gets. There was more here that I didn't get down. Resume at 11:20.
Now, I am going to end the session shortly. It was, of course, no coincidence that our friend came here this evening. Besides giving you necessary information for the appendix, some of the information given on objects and symbolism definitely applied to Sue.
To me.
I feel sorry for you.
Why?
Because you have been writing so steadily.
I'm okay.
There is one point I can add here in connection with the religious drama of Christ and the disciples. As Rupert said after reading the body of the book, the interior drama is the real one. Christ became the crucified. Judas became the betrayer, though Christ was not crucified and Judas did not betray him. The reality, therefore, was in the myth. The reality was the myth. In such cases, the interior events will always predominate, regardless of the physical facts, which are only symbols for these events. Now, I bid you a fond good evening.
Good evening, Seth. It's been a pleasure. To Sue.
And I will let my friend Rupert slide back down.
Sue. All right. Good night. 11:25 p.m. Once out of trance, Jane had little to say. I'm just sitting here watching you two busy bees, she grinned, as Sue and I worked on our separate notes. Before break at 11:10, Sue wrote, when Seth told me that he was speeding up the acceleration to see if I could perceive it, I had the definite feeling of greater speed and a visual change in Jane's body. It seemed to become smaller, as though I were looking at it through the wrong end of binoculars. This was again connected with motion, as though the physical frequency was also changed, and Jane's body was rushing past me, even while staying in the same place. Then, when Jane came out of trance at last break, I felt as though a force had been released in front of me, so that if I wasn't careful, I could topple over. And the same thing now, after the session. Session 595, September 20th, 1971, 9:01 p.m., Monday. The first part of the session was given over to a friend who needed help with a personal problem. She taped Seth's information, then left when break came at 9:45. I had two questions for our portion of the session, and we expected that Seth's answers would be included in the appendix of his book. The first question, according to Seth, he, Jane, and I lived in Denmark in the 1600s. I simply wanted clarification of the data on my lifespan as given in the notes at the end of the 541st session in Chapter 11. The second question. Did Seth intend to title Part 1 and Part 2 of his book as he had his chapters? Resume at 10:05.
Now.
Good evening, Seth.
Now I have to speak more slowly, you see. The information on the Denmark life in Chapter 11 is correct, except for a misinterpretation. That was one life divided into two separate periods. Literally, a life divided in terms of interests, concentration of abilities, and lifestyles. Aside from the information given in that chapter, there have been distortions in some past material concerning that life. These were not caused by Rupert's feeling about reincarnation. They were simply a result of correlating many details into the correct specific pattern. Some of the names given, for example, applied to friends rather than to yourselves. The overall picture, the validity of the existence carried through the distortions, however. I was a spice merchant. You were originally an artist, who turned rather dramatically into a landowner and against your youthful ways. Rupert was a dabbler in art as a young man also, and you resented this, grown fat and prosperous. You wanted him to go into more acceptable work, and you were ashamed of your own early wanderings as an itinerant artist. Here, the division was set between the idea of owning property as opposed to being an artist. In this life, that has caused you considerable unease.
10:13. This is very true, and for whatever reasons, in this life I have insisted upon being an artist in spite of all obstacles. In the 223rd session for January 16, 1966, Seth said that my name in the Denmark life was Lars Devensdorf. My wife then was named Letty Klus. My son, who is now Jane, was Grattan. Seth, a prosperous merchant, traveler, and family friend, was named Brons Martens.
The general itinerary of my journeys, as given in that session by Rupert, was correct. There were some distortions in other portions of that session, however.
Long pause at 10:15.
The details that so concern you now are, of course, important, and yet in a larger way it is the deep emotional experience of your life that is later remembered. Basically, the names and dates are meaningless to the inner self. Therefore, in reincarnational data, the emotional values will come through more vividly and with much less distortion. You place upon names and dates an importance you presently find of critical import. You insist upon them to add to the validity of past life narratives. Yet these are precisely those things that are forgotten first, and that have least value psychologically.
10:20.
Certain names will, therefore, spring into immediacy. You insist that the names be neatly placed, and yet often the inner self has great difficulty in this regard, for names simply do not matter. Persons and events of meaning carrying strong emotional charges will come through far clearer. Dates that are associated with emotional events will also be recalled. The past life is,
smile,
like a crossword puzzle that must be put together, but at its center is the emotional reality from which the puzzle springs.
Seth smiled because of Jane's recently developed rather strong interest in crossword puzzles. I enjoy them also. We've been speculating about the symbolic reasons behind our involvement.
Many such reincarnational narratives are liberally sprinkled with names and dates simply to satisfy those who insist upon them, because the emotional and psychological validity may not be accepted otherwise. This applies to any kind of reincarnational material, however it may be obtained. Now, if the life in question is a recent one in your terms, the details may be more readily recalled and far more precise. Even a life centuries ago may be perfect in detail, however, if it included, for example, battles or events of great import, where the dates themselves were impressed upon the personalities because of the occurrences at those times.
10:29.
Any emotional experience that is highly charged will carry a barrage of details along with it, but usual dates and usual names have little meaning. They have little meaning in your own reality. Basically speaking, relationships are far more important, and these you do not forget. These lives exist simultaneously across the board, however. This you should not forget. The useless paraphernalia is not important to the various personalities, however, now or then. Do you follow me?
Yes.
The reincarnational structure is built along the same lines of existence that you know now. Some individuals are more intrigued by detail than others. A particular previous personality may be one who had a great love of detail, in which case you would discover the richness of it. The particular likes and dislikes of any given personality will also have much to do with the descriptions given of a particular reincarnational episode. It will do no good to ask deep questions concerning the history of the times of some personality who was impoverished, ignorant, and limited. He simply would not know the answers. The picture of any given life, therefore, usually comes through the experience of the personality who lived it.
Pause at 10:35.
Again, those details will emerge that were important to him. In my particular case, I am so unfocused on my own reincarnational selves, and they have gone so far on their own, that I have little feeling of immediacy. Since we,
Seth, Jane, and I,
have been so involved, however, those relationships remain important. And in your terms, our present relationship was latent then. The Denmark life exists as much as this one does for you. You are simply focused within this picture of reality. Now you may take your break.
Thank you. 10:37 to 10:50.
Now, the reincarnational structure is a psychological one. It cannot be understood in any other terms. The distortions and interpretations that have built up about it are natural enough, considering what seems to be your practical experience with the nature of time. The reality, the validity, the immediacy of those lives do exist simultaneously with your present life. The distance between one life and another exists psychologically, and not in terms of years or centuries. The psychological distance, however, can be far more vast. There are certain lives, as there are certain events in this life, that you may not want to face or deal with. There may be great temperamental differences in some cases between your personality in one given life and another, so that your present self simply could not relate to the other's experience. You will be more strongly drawn to those past lives that somehow reinforce your own at this time. You realize that your early memories are sparse. Most of you remember little of the years spent as an infant and child. You make use of the knowledge gained then, and while it is part of you, you are not aware of it consciously, and so you are not consciously aware of other reincarnational existences.
In a whisper, humorously.
New paragraph. Earlier in this book, I mentioned alternate presents on several occasions, and reincarnational lives are indeed alternate presents. There is interaction between you and your reincarnational selves constantly. There is, as your friend Sue Watkins said, constant action across the board.
1101.
Those selves are not dead, in other words. Your understanding of this must be limited because you automatically think in terms of one life experience at a time and in linear patterns of development. In your terms, a reincarnational self can be aware of your environment and interact sometimes through your own relationships. Certain present happenings can indeed spark such interactions. In quite other terms, however, the reincarnated personality, while interacting with or through you, can still be having other kinds of experience at other levels.
Jane's delivery was quite animated and positive here, as though Seth wanted her gestures to underscore the material.
Because time is open-ended as you think of it, you can also affect what you would think of as past reincarnational selves, and at times react in and to their environment. You would usually do this in the dream state, but this is often accomplished just below the level of waking consciousness and is blotted out by you as you go about your daily business.
1107.
Strong emotional associations can often trigger such responses.
Pause.
Reincarnation, as it is usually explained, in terms of one life before another, is a myth, but a myth enabling many to partially understand facts that they would otherwise dismiss, insisting as they do upon the concept of a continuity of time. Now, you may take a break or end the session.
We'll take the break, Seth. 1110. Jane had been way out, as she often puts it. She remembered only the first sentence or so of the material. All of her trances have been deep this evening. It takes her a bit longer to leave such a state. Her eyes roll up occasionally, etc. At break, I repeated my question about titles for parts 1 and 2 of Seth's book. Resume in the same manner at 1124.
Now, we do not need to name the 2 portions separately. I had thought of specifically having the first part deal with inner and outer immediate environments, and then to lead to the larger reality of the soul and its perception in the second part. This is what I did, but the material is so interwoven that I felt the given separation enough, and did not want to reinforce the idea of a division.
Smiling.
Now, I could go on for hours, but I suggest that you get your rest.
It will be appreciated, the rest, that is. And although I was getting weary, it was apparent that Seth could easily shift into a state where his energy would seem inexhaustible.
I bid you a most fond good evening.
I thought the personal material you gave for our witness tonight before first break was excellent.
It was indeed. It was tailor-made for her. Now, when the appendix is done and your work with this book is finished, I will give you as many sessions as you would like, within reason, for yourself, and use the recorder.
Okay, good night, Seth, and thank you. 11:27 p.m. That was funny, Jane said, after she rested for a few minutes. I was really out that last time, but it was for such a short time that I really felt the transitions from here to there and back. That word Sue used, acceleration, is a good one. See the 594th session. Session 596, September 27th, 1971, 9:24 p.m., Monday. Jane and I worked on proofreading Seth's book for an hour or so after supper, and then went for a walk. It was a warm and rainy fall evening, already dark and very pleasant. There was a scattering of wet fallen leaves about. By 8:30, we were back home. We sat in the living room with the lights off so that we could see outside easily. Jane had finished the introduction to Seth's book today. This, in turn, reminded her of her own manuscript, The Physical Universe as Idea Construction, which she discusses in the introduction. She had read it again today, and it still intrigues her. She said again that she'd like to do something with it on her own eventually. 9 o'clock passed almost unnoticed as we talked. I turned on a couple of lights when we finally got down to the business of holding a session. Jane wanted more material for the appendix of Seth's book. She said that the living room seemed different this evening, significant. But it was a nice difference, she added. She began speaking for Seth in a very quiet voice. Her pace was rather slow, her eyes closed often.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now, the physical universe as idea construction, mentioned by Rubert in his introduction, did indeed represent our first formal contact, although Rubert was not aware of it at that time. The experience came within a framework that he could accept, that of highly accelerated inspiration. His consciousness left his body only after he was in the throes of what seemed to him to be inspiration of almost unbearable intensity. Had his habits instead led him, say, to regular prayer, then that framework could also have been used. In all such cases, several qualities are apparent: an ability to look inward, to concentrate deeply, to lose the sharp edges of the physically oriented self in contemplation, and an intense desire to learn. These must be coupled with the inner confidence that pertinent knowledge can be directly received. To those who believe that all answers are known, there is little need to search. Such information, such inspired writing, usually appears within frameworks of the personality that have already been set and formed. The context in which such knowledge appears will often vary, therefore. In some cases, the framework itself is used for a final time, with the initial inspired knowledge, the knowledge itself, escaping from the framework and growing out of the context that allowed for its birth.
Pause at 9:35, one of many. Jane's delivery was more vigorous by now, however.
Above all, individuals who receive such information in states of expanded consciousness are already those who feel deeply within themselves connections not only with the earth itself, but with deeper realities. Consciously, they may often be unaware of this basic quality within themselves. They do not accept answers given by others, but insist upon finding their own. These searches may appear erratic. There is a fine impatience, a divine discontent that drives them on until the frontiers within their own personalities are finally opened. The knowledge gained must then be integrated by the physical personality, and yet, by its nature, valid knowledge of this kind will shed out its light and make its own way. The energy generated by some such experiences is enough to change a life in a matter of moments, and to affect the understanding and behavior of others. There are intrusions of knowledge from one dimension of activity to another. They are highly charged and volatile. Unknowingly, the individual who receives such information is himself a part of it. The entire feeling tone of his present personality is changed, and directly, by the information he receives. To the extent that he is true to his own vision, possibilities of expansion are available to him that he could hardly have achieved otherwise. Often the information given clashes with previously held ideas and beliefs, however. Otherwise, there would be no need for the sometimes explosive, intrusive qualities of such experiences, for there would be no barriers.
Long pause at 9:45.
Such personalities often, then, must learn to correlate their intuitive knowledge to reform intellectual frameworks strong enough to support it. Such personalities also are usually gifted with the ability to draw upon unusual amounts of energy. Often they must learn at a fairly young age not to dissipate the energy. They can seem, for example, to go off in many directions at once before this lesson is brought home. The late 30s and early 40s are frequently involved simply because the need to know in such personalities often reaches a peak then. The required patterns of behavior are sufficiently set. The energy has been directed, and the individual has had enough time to realize that the accepted frameworks and answers make little sense to him. At their strongest, such experiences can propel intuitive knowledge from the private domain to change civilization. The incredible charge is always in the initial experience. Contained within it is the condensed energy from which all other developments come. The personality involved can react in many ways. Great adjustments are necessary, and often changes of behavior. The individual now realizes that he is indeed a living web of reality, and this becomes immediate conscious knowledge.
This, of course, is what happened to Jane. Pause at 9:58.
Such knowledge requires not only more responsive and responsible behavior, but involves a sympathy with life that may earlier have been lacking. The sympathy brings with it a sensitivity that is strong, challenging, and intense. Many individuals have experienced unusual, quite valid, and intense expansions of consciousness, but found themselves unable to correlate the new knowledge with past beliefs, to make the changes necessary to handle the sensitivity. Indeed, they were not strong enough to contain the experience. In such cases, they tried to close it off, deny it, forget it.
10.05.
Others never allowed it to escape from the framework or the context from which it had sprung. They were then unable to escape. They could not free themselves. If the information seemed to be coming initially from their God, for example, they continued to think in their particular way about God, even though the experience and the information given should have brought them far beyond such a point.
Jane's voice was still relatively quiet as she spoke for Seth, but her delivery was faster and much more intense now, and she used many gestures.
Rupert, for example, would have made the same error had he not been led by his experience beyond the framework of inspiration that had given it birth.
Pause.
In this case, then, he was propelled into new concepts because he had the sense to reject old ones and the courage to go ahead. The going ahead involved him...
Long pause.
With my ideas of the God concept. Before our sessions, he was so disillusioned that he would not even consider any questions dealing with religious matters.
To me.
Are you tired?
We hadn't had a break yet, but I nodded no. It was raining harder now. Along with that sound, I had been hearing someone move back and forth in the apartment above us.
Now, such experiences or such doorways to knowledge are available to each individual. And to some extent, each individual partakes in them. They appear in much less conspicuous form, often in intuitive decisions made with seeming suddenness, beneficial changes, intuitive hunches. Often, midway in life, an individual will suddenly seem to see things clearly in a physical manner, straightening out his affairs. A life that seems headed for disaster will suddenly become victorious, for example. These are all variations of the same experience, though in lesser form.
Pause at 10:15.
In normal living and in day-by-day experience, all the knowledge you need is available. You must, however, believe that it is. Put yourself in a position to receive it by looking inward and remaining open to your intuitions, and most important, by desiring to receive it. I said a few paragraphs back that individuals such as Rupert are themselves a portion of the knowledge they receive. This applies to each person, each reader.
Long pause.
There is a great fallacy operating. People believe that there is one great truth, that it will appear and they will know it. Now, a flower is a truth. So is a lamp bulb. So is an idiot and a genius, a glass and an ant. There is little exterior similarity, however.
10:24.
Truth is all of these seemingly distinct, separate, different realities. So Rupert is a part of the truth he perceives, and each of you are part of the truths that you perceive. Truth, reflected through Rupert, becomes in a way new truth, for it is perceived uniquely, as it would be for each individual who perceived it. It is not less truth or more truth in those terms. It becomes new truth. Now, you may take your break.
10:26. It took Jane a few minutes to come out of a very deep trance. Her voice had remained quiet for the most part, but had become very intent. She had no idea that she'd been speaking for just over an hour. "Wow, he sure had me out that time," she said. "I know why, too. The noise upstairs really began to bother me. so Seth put me under even deeper. I knew I was going to get something on idea construction for the appendix, though, she continued. It's been a most enjoyable evening. She was very happy about the session. I thought she was sensitive to noise tonight, because she didn't want to be interrupted while getting this particular material. The upstairs apartment was quiet now. The effects of the deep trance lingered. Jane yawned again and again. She walked about the room, sipping a beer and smoking a cigarette. The warm rain continued. I asked Jane if she wanted to end the session, but she chose to continue in spite of her yawns. Resume in the same manner at 10:45.
Now, such new truths can still be very ancient indeed. But truth is not a thing that must always have the same appearance, shape, form, or dimension. Those who persist, therefore, in shielding their truths from questions threaten to destroy the validity of their knowledge. Again, those who are so certain of their answers will lack that need to know that can lead them into still greater dimensions of understanding. Any valid expansion of consciousness is itself, of course, a part of the message. The personality finds itself encountering living truth and knows that truth only exists in those terms. I have used the term expansion of consciousness here rather than the more frequently used cosmic consciousness, because the latter implies an experience of proportions not available to mankind at this time. Intense expansions of consciousness, by contrast to your normal state, may appear to be cosmic in nature, but they barely hint at those possibilities of consciousness that are available to you now, much less begin to approach a true cosmic awareness.
10:55.
The ideas presented in this book should allow many readers to expand their perceptions and consciousness in ways they may not have believed possible. The book itself is written in such a way that all those ready to learn will benefit. There is meaning not only in the written words themselves, but connections existing between them that do not appear, and that will have meanings to various levels of the personality.
Jane, in trance, tried to light a book match several times, but it was evidently too damp. She finally had to put her new cigarette aside.
The integrity of any intuitive information depends upon the inner integrity of the person who receives it. Expansion of consciousness, therefore, requires honest self-appraisal, an awareness of one's own beliefs and prejudices. It brings a gift and a responsibility. All who wish to look within themselves, to find their own answers, to encounter their own appointment with the universe, should therefore become well acquainted with the intimate workings of their own personality. That is it.
As Seth, Jane leaned forward, her eyes opened wider and quite dark. Okay.
And it is it for our appendix. You may ask questions, take a break, or end the session as you prefer.
We'll take the break then. 11:02 to 11:09.
Such self-knowledge is in itself highly advantageous, and in one way is its own reward. It is impossible, however, to look inward with any clearness if you are unwilling to change your attitudes, beliefs, or behavior, or examine those characteristics that you consider uniquely your own. You cannot examine reality without examining yourself, in other words. You cannot hold encounters with all that is apart from yourself, and you cannot separate yourself from your experience. You cannot use truth. It cannot be manipulated. Whoever thinks he is manipulating truth is manipulating himself. You are truth. Then discover yourself. And now, I will say good evening.
As Seth, Jane slapped her knee, grinning. Okay, Seth, thank you very much.
We will still have our own sessions when circumstances allow.
All right, good. When this book is finished, I guess.
My heartiest regards.
Thank you. The same to you. Good night.
11:16 p.m. Gee, I really feel good, Jane said, when she finally came out of another deep trance. But I think I can just about make it to bed. She was yawning again and very relaxed. The soft, pleasant rain continued. Jane Roberts, ESP class session, Tuesday, June 23, 1970. Some 16 members of Jane's ESP class were present when this session was taped. In the session, here slightly abbreviated, Seth discusses organization in our present reality, among others. See the 537th session in Chapter 9 for material on after-death organization.
Now, if you want organization, then you shall have it, at any time. You structure your own existence, and you choose those realities that have exactly as much organization as you need at any given time. In this reality, you very nicely emphasize all the similarities which bind you together. You make a pattern of them, and you very nicely ignore all the dissimilarities. Out of a vast field of perception, you choose to focus your attention upon certain specific areas and to ignore all others. And so there is perfect agreement among you as far as this small area is concerned. The vastness that you do not perceive does not bother you at all, and you do not ask questions about it. And yet it exists. I have said this before. If you were able to focus your attention upon the dissimilarities, merely those that you can perceive but do not, then you would be amazed that mankind can form any idea of an organized reality.
As Seth, Jane looked at the couch where Mary and Art were sitting.
I look now between the two of you. When the others look at our friends here on the fancy blue couch, they see a picture of true organization. There is an individual there,
pointing,
and an individual there with space between. The picture is equalized. It appears perfect and organized. However, the space between our two friends is not vacant. You think of it as vacant because you do not perceive what is there. The picture appears to be very organized. As soon as you realize that the picture is not complete, however, then you must begin to ask new questions, and the old idea of the perfect organization is gone. Now, as you know, you do not perceive the atoms and molecules that swim about the room, nor those that fill the space between our two friends, nor the forces, the field forces that exist. The couch serves to unite them since they sit upon it. And what do they sit upon? Emptiness that you perceive as solidity? Now, without your particular physical senses, you would not perceive the couch as solid. Consciousness that has different perceptive mechanisms than your own is unaware of our now famous blue couch. You make the organization. Your thoughts perceive an organization. You enforce the organization and indeed create it.
Question from a class member. Do we all create the same organization and see the same couch? To Mary and Art.
You each generally agree, I am sure, that you sit upon a couch. You do not perceive the same couch. You only perceive your own idea constructions. You cannot see those of another. Telepathically, you transpose your ideas in line with what you know of the other person's thinking. You agree that the couch is here? Now, it is true that within your physical system, for I know this will come next, you can measure your couch. I expect at any moment that someone will get a ruler and measure it, and then say to me that the couch is so long. How can I say it is not one couch? However, within your physical system, the instruments themselves are distorted, and of course they will agree with what they measure. There is no reason why they should not. Telepathically, you all agree on the placement of objects and their dimensions. Now, You use atoms and molecules in a strange way. You transpose your ideas upon them. You perceive them in a certain fashion. I am not blaming you. I have done it too in my time, and there is good reason for it. But the fact is that physical matter is not solid except when you believe that it is, and that organization is transposed from within upon the without. It is not transposed from the without upon you. You form the reality that you know, and even though the table holds up your arms and you may lean upon it and write, I still tell you that the table is not solid. This makes little difference as long as you can write upon it. It makes little difference as long as you can sit upon your blue couch. But when you leave your physical system and when your physical perception is no longer the rule, then you must learn new root assumptions. Root assumptions are those laws upon which you agree in any system of reality. You agree, for example, upon what objects are physical. It makes little difference whether they are or not, as long as you agree upon this. Your consciousness belongs in a body. You would not be caught dead with your consciousness outside of your body. It is taboo. Now, the fact is that your consciousness is not imprisoned within your body. But as long as you believe that it is, again, you will not be caught dead outside of it. And when you are caught dead outside of it, there will be some amazement indeed. There are other root assumptions that you take as a basis of reality. And in other levels of reality, there are other root assumptions. These are the seeming laws by which you govern your experiences. Our note-takers are doing very well, considering that the paper is not solid and neither are their pens. It is amazing what you can do with nothing.
Break and discussion.
You are true multidimensional personalities, as I have said before. At some point in your development, you will become more and more aware of the true nature of your identity. There is, for example, a part of you who is very aware of the pulsations you have just been discussing, and who is aware of the pulse-like nature of memory. When the pulse is in this physical reality, then you, as you know yourselves, have memory of this existence. When the pulse is in another dimension, there is memory of that existence. Now a portion of your entire identity has memory of both. The entire personality structure dwells in many dimensions and simultaneously. You are at the very beginning of any idea of psychology. You simply do not realize what you are now. And as I've said before, when you ask me questions about life after death, you automatically transpose, if you will forgive me, this lack of knowledge into the next realm. Therefore, sometimes I am at a loss to answer your questions. You are learning to know yourselves. At the rate you are going, it will take you some time. Now, when you properly understand how to use psychological time, then to some extent you can learn to alter the nature and focus of your consciousness. You can turn it in many directions. You can focus it in other ways, away from physical reality. This does not mean that you will be left high and dry here. It does mean that you will begin to explore the reality of yourselves and of those other dimensions in which you have your existence. There must be, however, a willingness to admit that there are other dimensions in which you exist. You must also have faith in your physical self, faith that it will be here when you get back, and I assure you that it will. There is no other way, and I repeat this, there is no other way of getting first-hand information about other realities except by the exploration and manipulation of your own consciousness. Now, when I speak to you, I very seldom use such words as love. I do not tell you that a God is waiting for you on the other side of a golden door. I do not reassure you by telling you that when you are dead, God will be waiting for you in all his majestic mercy, and that will be the end of your responsibility. And so, as I said last evening in my latest chapter,